We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. This morning, both shows will be coming from the Focus Archives, their programs broadcast earlier this year. So as you listen to the program today, do keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. It's been 10 years since the shootings at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado. Two boys, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, killed 13 and injured 24 others before killing themselves. It was a story that got attention not only around the country but around the world. We'll be talking this morning with Dave Cullen. He's a journalist who's devoted much of the last 10 years to trying to understand how and why Columbine happened. And he says that much of what we have been told, or perhaps would say we know, about that day in 1999 is simply not true. He says the real story is much more nuanced and complicated. He has written about it in his recently published book. The title is Columbine. The book is out now if you'd like to read it. Also, he has a very good website that has a great deal of information on there. So if you have internet access, you can look at his website, DaveCullen.com. That's C-U-L-L-E-N. He's a journalist and author. He's contributed to Slate.com, Salon.com, and also the New York Times, and is considered to be the country's foremost authority on the Columbine events. He's also written on a number of other subjects. He's joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Cullen, hello.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Good. Thanks for having me on today.
Well, I really appreciate you giving us some of your time. And, you know, just to pick up on that point that I mentioned there right at the beginning about how much perhaps misinformation there is, I think that what we want people to understand is that a lot of this was the result of, at the time, a lot of confusion. There were people trying to figure out what was going on. There was a lot of confusing detail that came out. In fact, that was some of it was eyewitness accounts. People said this is what happened, this was what's going on. A lot of it was actually said in the course of the event unfolding. And I think what you would say is that the sort of the problem is that a lot of that went into the record and then people went on.
Right.
And nobody really went back nowhere near to the extent that you have, went back and tried to look at what happened, what was reported, and try and square that all up to get a much better, more complete kind of picture of the event and particularly of Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, who they were and what their motivations were.
Right. You know, in the first, turned out to be the first hours, and particularly the first days after that where we repeated what we had mistakenly said, in those early hours and days, we got most of the what right. There were some errors on what happened, but they weren't too significant, and we largely corrected those. We really blew it on the why. And the reason we blew it on the why is because we had just about nothing to go on. And so we were essentially making it up. I mean, we were taking little fragments of evidence we had and constructing entire ideas out of it, much like happened with Oklahoma City, actually, although that was corrected. But if you remember, right after Oklahoma City, pretty much everybody in the country, people were on the news saying this openly. We assumed it was, you know, Arab Muslim terrorists. Of course, you know, it was a terrorist act. It must be, you know, some people from the Middle East. That's who did terrorists. And so we were shocked when we found out that, you know, it was this Tim McVeigh guy with a crew cut from a white guy from Michigan. But then we had Tim McVeigh's face in front of us, so for years, and so that put that to rest. But we went off just as half-cocked in that situation and went off with, you know, ideas and had ourselves convinced within hours that's what it must be. Mm-hmm. And with Columbine, we did a really similar thing. We took little fragments of traumatized kids coming out of the school telling us why the killers had done it, as if, you know, 16-year-old kids are mind readers and able to divine the motive of a person staring at them with a weapon. That's kind of ridiculous on its face that we would say, oh, okay, this the 60-year-old can read the killer's mind and know why he's doing it. We took things that they had, you know, obviously conclusions they had jumped to. We had taken mistaken ideas about profiles of previous shooters. Those profiles turned out to be incorrect and also unrelated to this case. It was sort of a double problem, but we took those previous profiles we thought we had and assumed those applied to Eric and Dylan. And we made all kinds of assumptions and really constructed the idea of these killers and their motives. And, you know, we thought we'd done a pretty good job. After a day or two, you know, we brushed our hands and pat ourselves on the back for having put it all together. And none of the evidence had yet arrived to tell us why this had actually happened.
And this there is a considerable amount of evidence, although it wasn't available initially. It was something that I know you fought to get access to that you could take advantage of. And on top of that, you spent a lot of time talking to whoever would talk with you. One of the things I know from having seen some of the interviews that you've done and talking about the book is that for you, this long journey also had a fairly significant emotional toll. It wasn't easy for you to immerse yourself in this story and to try to get into the heads of these two boys, particularly Eric Harris. So that invites this question, well, what, you know, other reporters covered this and then they went on to other stories. This seems for you, this was a story that would not let go of you.
Yeah, that's about it. You know, I hate resorting to cliches, but when people ask, you know, why I picked this of all topics, I do have to resort to the one that that I've heard many times that I didn't feel like I picked it. I felt like it picked me. I definitely did not ever have an urge to write a book about Columbine or write a book about murders and mass killings. I had never immersed myself in a topic like this or expected to or foreseen this coming. But I started covering it the first day. I was out there about a little more than an hour after the shooting first started and covering it initially for Salon.com. And, yeah, the more I was there, the more I just had to know more. And really, there were two things that drove me. The second thing turned out to be the killers, and I eventually really had to know what happened with them. But the first thing that really got me hooked was the kids and the survivors who lived through it. And it was really the second day. I didn't expect to write a book the second day, but looking back, I got hooked on the story the second day because the afternoon Columbine happened, out there at the school or around the school, it was complete panic. Kids were screaming, crying, hugging each other. It was exactly what you would picture. And the next morning was not. The next morning at 10 a.m. when I got out to Clement Park, the area surrounding the school, the kids were completely different. No one was crying. And the boys, in particular, were not showing any emotion at all. Their faces were blank. There were these vacant stares. And it was really disconcerting. And at first I was afraid to talk to them about it because I thought they might be unaware and be like, what are you, some jerk reporter asking me, you know, psychoanalyzing me? But it turned out they wanted to talk about it. They were very aware of it. They were scared about it. And they were, which set up something I would find over the coming years, is they were extremely articulate about what they were going through. They typically, and in this case, they didn't know how to solve it. But, and they knew that, and they wanted help, but they knew what was happening to them and could talk about it. And I was really nervous that first morning among them of what is going to happen to these kids. Are they really going to get through this? Are they going to be traumatized for life? Will this be a lost generation of 2,000 survivors? And I had to know what happened to them. Mm-hmm. I just had to keep coming back just to find out.
Yeah, our guest, just let me very quickly introduce again, is Dave Cullen. He is the author of the book Columbine, which is brings together the result of his reporting over literally over a period of 10 years on the school shootings that took place in Columbine in 1999. The book is published by 12 Books, and that for people might indeed remember some of the reporting about 12 when it got started. It's a company that was started by a bunch of people who said, we want to just publish 12 books a year, one every month, and really concentrate on finding good books and promoting them well and this is one of them. It's out now in the bookstores. Also, a lot of information about him and about Columbine on his website. You can take a look at that. Questions are welcome, too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The sort of conventional narrative, the explanation for this, what happened, why Eric and Dylan did what they did, the thing that I'm sure people will remember is that the two boys were social outcasts and they were seeking revenge for having been bullied, and that there were particular, if not particular, individuals that they were targeting. They were people from, you know, particular people from the high school class structure, you know, particular kind of people that they were after.
Particularly jocks.
And because the story goes, these people had hassled them, and so they had it. They got to the point where they just couldn't take it anymore. They snapped, and so this violent event was the result. And there are, we can unpack this because there are a whole lot of things here that clearly are actually not true. Maybe starting with the idea that, yes, the two of them, particularly Eric Harris, wanted to hurt people. And wanted to hurt as many people as possible, but no specific people, no particular people. They just wanted, he and particularly Eric, just wanted to hurt as many people as he could.
Exactly. You know, and all those, you're right, all those are most of the main things that we hear about Columbine. When I do readings, I talk to lots of people. Well, I've been talking to people for 10 years, and that's what pretty much everything, what everyone thinks happened, and none of that is true. Now, the thing is, the reason that these myths got the currency they did is because there's a kernel of truth in every one of these things. There had been a longstanding feud. The previous year, it was actually over, but there had been a feud between the jocks at the school and a group of sort of, I wouldn't call them outcasts, that's strong, but a bunch of kids who were not mainstreamers. There was, and it was called the Trench Coat Mafia. There was such a group in the school. The killers did wear trench coats. We took all those things, added them up together, and connected them all. Not everything is connected. Eric and Dylan were not members of the Trench Coat Mafia. They wore the trench coats because they knew those kids, and it was a fashion statement, and also to cover all the weapons that they had rigged all over their bodies. But you're right. That wasn't what any of it was about. None of that had anything to do with it. And Eric and Dylan didn't personally feel bullied by those jocks. They had not been part of that long-running feud. So when that was unearthed, you know, we sort of missed the big piece, like, well, were these kids connected to it? Another truth is that there was bullying at Columbine High, just as there is at probably every high school in America. However, Eric and Dylan didn't feel bullied. Particularly, Eric saw himself as a bullier, definitely not as a victim. They never complained about that. They were not outcasts or loners. And like you said, maybe the biggest single myth of Columbine is that it wasn't even intended as a school shooting. What they were intending was a bombing, and the worst bombing in American history, the worst terrorist attack in American history. The person that they saw as the person they wanted to top was Tim McVeigh. They wanted this to be bigger than Oklahoma City, and it would have been if Eric had known how to wire bombs as well as they thought he did. Mm-hmm. So they brought two big bombs into the cafeteria, propane tank-based bombs, just like those big white tanks, you know, that might be on your patio right now for your backyard barbecue that you get at the supermarket. They had put one of those each into a duffel bag, rigged up with gasoline, nails for shrapnel, and timers, those little old-fashioned clocks with the little bells on the top. Mm-hmm. They wired it all together, and those two bombs, if they had worked properly, would have killed everyone in the cafeteria instantly, which was more than 500 people. And Eric and Dylan set the timers to go off at 11:17 and immediately left the cafeteria, went out into the parking lot, pulled their guns out of their cars, and took up their positions where they could triangulate two of the three main exits. So as the school blew up and survivors were rushing out of the exits, Eric and Dylan would mow them down with automatic weapons. And that's when the shooting was supposed to be involved.
Yeah. And as far as the shooting that did occur, it seems that the evidence shows that certainly rather than them targeting specific people, they were just they were shooting people as they came to them, as they came to hand. They just, someone was standing in front of them, they shot that person. It didn't really matter so much who that person was.
Exactly. They realized within 2 minutes the bombs weren't going off. They met in the parking lot at the top of a hill near one of the entrances, and Eric literally started shooting at everything that moved. There was a lot of commotion immediately. People started running. He shot in every direction. He was a pretty poor shot, and it's hard to hit a long-range target or a moving target, so he missed almost everyone outside. But he did shoot at just about everyone. Dylan was really slow to get involved, just as he was slow in the planning and kind of reticent about being involved in Columbine. Once it got going, he was slow there too. He only fired his weapon 5 times outside the building. Now, inside, he would do some horrible things and start getting involved when they were standing side by side. But out there, he was slow. Eric, though, just as planned, was completely random, shot at every single person. So there was no targeting involved whatsoever.
I think you've really said that in order to try to understand what happened, you really need to understand as much as you can the two boys. And you make the point that they are very different. The two of them are very different. Yep. What their mindset and motivation was very different. And in fact, maybe contrary to the kind of conventional thing where people say, well, events like these are inexplicable. They cannot be understood. The people cannot be understood. It sounds as if you would say, well, actually, no, I think maybe it's difficult to understand, but you would say when you look at them, you look at the extensive written record that they left behind, you could actually get a pretty good sense of who they were, how they thought, how they looked at the world, how they felt about themselves, and how all of that led to what they did.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. You definitely can. And stepping back for a second to the bigger picture, too, I was actually invited to a conference at Harvard a couple months ago because of this with experts on trauma and murder who have covered things from everywhere from the Middle East. We had a psychiatrist who had been a survivor of a Serbian concentration camp, people who rape and murder, and really high-powered people who have been studying this for years. And this very idea was brought up there of, some people often say, some events just, there is no explanation. And pretty much everybody at that conference who'd been working on this for years and decades said, that is complete bunk. There is always a reason. The perpetrator always has a reason. Nobody does something for no reason. You as the person, as the reader or the viewer, the person studying it, may not accept those reasons, or they may not seem like reasonable reasons to you, but that's not really the point. Of course you're not a murderer, and that's why the murderer's reasons often seem off to you. But if you want to understand the murderer or the person who perpetrates this stuff, they always have a reason. And Eric and Dylan definitely had reasons. They had completely different reasons, as you said. They were mirror image people. And one of the interesting things about Columbine is that Eric understood Dylan's motivation. And Eric understood that he was doing it for different reasons than Dylan. And Eric played to Dylan's reasons. And Eric helped convince Dylan why he would want to do it. Eric knew the difference. Instead of trying to convince Dylan for his own reasons, he knew what would appeal to Dylan and made it work for Dylan. So he saw the psychology of both of the two killers better than probably anyone. And we can talk about each of them if you like. But yes, you nailed it.
Let's do that. Eric Harris, clearly he was the leader.
Yep.
He was, as we said, he perhaps more, at least initially, more than Dylan, was someone who his motivation was he wanted to hurt people.
Exactly.
And he, as you have come to understand, and I'm sure other people who have looked at him have come to understand, here is someone who in many respects is a classic textbook case of a psychopath, a true psychopath.
Yes, he sure is. And that word sends some people astray because they have the idea from Hollywood. And, of course, Hollywood has really bastardized that term. So you've got to let go of Hannibal Lecter and all the things you have in your head of what a psychopath is. Because psychopaths, in addition to being sort of horrible and evil and ghastly on the inside, are incredible charmers. Don't think of Hannibal Lecter telling you he's going to eat your liver. He may well want to do something that horrible, but he's never going to tell you. Psychopaths are charming, and they're great master manipulators. They can read you like a book and play to you, and we tend to love them. So that's how a psychopath appears to us, and that's how Eric was able to get away with it. But inside, psychopaths are people with almost no feeling at all, definitely no compassion or no empathy for others, no regard for the feelings of others or what will happen to other people. So for the most trivial gain, a psychopath, on his own part, a psychopath will destroy your life. You know, a nickel to him is equal to $1 million for you if he's getting it, or your life if he, you know, has to kill you to get, you know, to get a Snickers bar or something. It's an easy choice for him. Usually they're not violent. They're rarely violent because there's no money in violence. Psychopaths are typically after money, status, power, the same things most people are after, except they're ruthless about it. And you see psychopaths as people like Bernie Madoff. They're frequently white-collar criminals, people with Ponzi schemes, con artists, people who are going to rip you off and who you never see coming. You know, the SEC didn't even take seriously allegations on Bernie Madoff and didn't even investigate it because he's Bernie Madoff. He's like, you know, everybody knows. He just exudes goodness and inspires confidence. That's what a psychopath is. But in the rare case when a psychopath also has a sadistic streak, man, you put those two things together, and that's terrifying. That's a situation where you get somebody like a Jeffrey Dahmer or a Ted Bundy or an Eric Harris.
Yeah, and Dylan, he here clearly, in as much as Eric was the leader, he was someone who knew how to manipulate people. Well, he certainly, Eric knew how to manipulate Dylan, and he was someone who didn't have this, at least initially, certainly didn't have this fundamental impulse to hurt people. It seems that he was, if anything, he wanted to hurt himself.
Exactly. You know, Dylan kept a journal for 2 years. We know a lot about both the killers because they both kept journals, so we know their inner thoughts. And Eric's journal is hate, hate, hate on every page. It opens with the phrase, "I hate the effing world." That's Eric, the psychopath. Dylan's journal, which lasts for 2 years, the most common word in there is love. He's drawing big, fluttering hearts all over the place. He's talking about loving. He's trying to be a good boy. He's a really sensitive, caring, loving boy with a lot of anger issues, too. Most of the anger is directed at himself. And he's talking about suicide from the first page. So for 2 years, he's talking about suicide and really not having the nerve to pull it off by himself. But he was trying to do the right thing. He talks about he calls it the everlasting conflict between good and evil. He uses that phrase constantly. And he sees himself coming out on the good side. He actually talks many times about the spiritual quest he's on and different things he's done to try to purify himself for God. He talks to God frequently in the journal, often in angry terms. He gets mad at God a lot because he sees himself sort of like Job. But he's trying to do the right thing. And to me, Dylan was really the revelation in this story. And he's the character, if I can call him that, who got me most interested as I read the book. Because what I tried to do with Dylan was show you a 2-year evolution of him. Here's a kid who's on a path who looks nothing like a murderer. You're reading this journal. It's not a murderer. I actually show the journal, the physical copy, at bookstore events where I do readings. I flip through it and show the audience, and they gasp when they see it. They cannot believe their eyes that this is a kid who ended up committing murder. So the question is, how does this loving, good kid end up a mass murderer 2 years later? And it's a slow progression. It's not, you know, it's not something I can tell you in 30 seconds, but the cliff notes is Eric happened to him. He met this diabolical psychopath who played to his weaknesses and who convinced Dylan that, you know, why are you taking all this out on yourself? Why are you beating up you? It's not you, dude. It's everybody else in the world. they did this to you. They're the ones who are awful. Show them. You know, go ahead and kill yourself, but show them on the way out. You know, take some of them with you and demonstrate to them just how mean they were to you and just how cruel this world has been to you, and make a statement. And that's 2 years later. That's what Dylan ends up doing.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Dave Cullen. He certainly, more than anybody else, is an authority on the Columbine school shootings that took place just a little over 10 years ago. He has contributed to Slate.com and Salon.com and the New York Times, and he has a book that's just recently been published about Columbine. It's published by 12. It's out in the bookstores now. Also, a lot of information about the book, about him, about the event on his website, which is Dave Cullen, C-U-L-L-E-N, DaveCullen.com. So you can look at that. You can go out and look for the book. Questions are welcome, 2-333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. You know, one other question particularly about Eric. You were talking a little bit earlier about the fact that most of the time psychopaths are people who their thing is playing others and manipulating people to their advantage. And that you, what you said was that when you get in the most dangerous area is if you get someone who has that kind of personality, who also has a sadistic streak. Those are the people that, that turn violent.
Yeah.
What if you have some feeling that you understand this? Did Eric? What did he think was going to happen afterwards, or did he in fact think about that?
He did, and he knew he was going to die. Both the killers write about that and talk about it on the videos. And they had two different ideas of their own death. For Dylan, it really was a suicide. And this was, for him, a suicide with homicide on the way out. For Eric, it was completely different. It was homicide. It was intended as mass murder with a sacrifice of his own death on the way out. And he talks about it that way in his journal pretty early on, almost a year out. He talks about, you know, how you people need to be shown, you know, who's the master and how screwed up you are, and I will give my life up to do it. And, you know, he gets into these little tirades, but he says several times how he's willing to make the ultimate sacrifice of his life to do it. So, I mean, this is so typical of a psychopath, that he's going to kill a bunch of people, do the most selfish thing possible, and yet constructed as this wonderful sacrifice, that he, as if he's doing something for humanity. But, you know, they can justify and rationalize anything, and Eric did, that he was willing to give up. What he was really doing was making a sacrifice for his own aggrandizement, which is really what's also going on with serial killers. When people like Ted Bundy or Jeffrey Dahmer become serial killers, they know they're going to get caught eventually. They know they're going to prison or death, and typically the one time a psychopath will kill himself is when he's cornered, and when there's no way out, he's not going to be taken alive. And they know it's going to end badly in the end. You know, you're not going to commit serial murders indefinitely without getting caught. And it's the same thing whether you do a series of murders or one big event. You know, the police are going to are going to obviously find out and do something. And in Eric's case, they assumed they would go down in a blaze of glory. He actually talks in one of the videos about he jokes and laughs about how he'll probably be shot in the head by a cop. And one of the things they didn't account for was the fact that, you know, 45 minutes into the attack, they would still be alive. Hmm. They thought the cops would have killed them by then, and they didn't really know. They didn't know what to do at that point. They seemed to have been wandering about that around that school for about half an hour after they stopped killing. They got bored with the killing, and they wandered around the school not really knowing what to do. They obviously couldn't get out of there. And I think they picture themselves going down in a blaze of glory like in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, probably dating myself for some of your listeners. But where they were surrounded at the end by like 1,000 cops all around, no way out. And, you know, they would make a play for it, and the cops would shoot them, and they'd be heroic. You know, I think that's how these two saw themselves going out. Didn't quite work that way.
Yeah.
Their suicide was really sort of humiliating and disgusting.
The big, I'm sure one of the big questions that you always are asked, and I'm sure that you've tried to confront, is this question: could it have been prevented? And certainly for the two boys, they were involved in the lead up to this, a series of property crimes, vandalism, things in, I suppose, in ascending level of seriousness.
Exactly.
There was this big, they left behind these voluminous journals. I think Eric actually had a web page, a website.
Yeah.
And so the question, I suppose, is, well, if people were really paying attention, were there signs there that were serious enough so that someone would have said, hey, you know, this is a disaster waiting to happen. We need to intervene and try to do something before something really bad happens.
Yes. Well, let me back up from that for a second, mm-hmm. and because that's a really complicated question. And I have 10 major storylines in the book, 10 each with a central character, because about half of it's about the killers and half of it's about the survivors. And with each of those storylines, what I set out to do was tell the story from the point of view of the lead character or characters in that story, of how they saw it at the time, the information they had to go on, what they were thinking and feeling, and why they did what they did, instead of imposing my judgments about them of what they had to go on. And what you've touched on brings up some of those different characters in the book, which is the killer's parents, mm-hmm. and also school officials and Jefferson County Sheriff's Officer, Jeffco, as we call them here. And I try to give all those same people the same benefit of the doubt as I gave people like, you know, the principal and the boy in the window and the various other characters I have in the book. And with the parents, I'm not going to say here, I'm not going to come to a conclusion, but what I'll tell you is that most of the people who I've spoken to go into the book blaming the parents. And most of the people who have finished reading do not. And it's been interesting at the bookstore events I've been doing, the later events, the crowds are split about 50-50 between people who have read the book already and are there to, you know, see me and talk about it, and half the people who haven't. And the room's divided right in the middle of between those groups. So I think seeing things from the parents' point of view will give you a new perspective of what they actually had to go on and the decisions they made. So they saw two kids who were acting out, who were getting into trouble. But does a parent think mass murderer? Is my kid a mass murderer? Now, the police are a different story. The police, well, part of the way they're the same story, because they also are getting, you know, vague reports of this kid, mainly of Eric Harris, acting up, you know, defaming people's houses. Vandalizing people's houses, making threats, and they're thinking, oh, you know, some freaking teenage boy. No kidding. We get a zillion of these a week. But so you got to think about the cops' point of view, too. And I've talked to a lot of cops, and they said, you know, we get juvenile delinquent. You know how many juvenile delinquent kids are out there? Mm-hmm. And most of them are not planning mass murder. You don't see this coming. But there was one point where that really changes, which is 1 year before Columbine, actually 13 months before, where the neighbor, Judy Brown, is tipped off that Eric Harris is making really wild threats on his website and prints off 9 pages of death threats, including death threats about her son, and brings them to the Jeffco cops. And these are very specific threats about murder and about mass murder. And also, on the website, he's bragging about making pipe bombs. And one of the investigators, investigator Mike Guerra, interviews them, does some research, puts all this together, and discovers that an unexploded pipe bomb has been found near Eric's house in a park just a few blocks away. And he realizes it matches the description. He puts all this together, and he drafts up an affidavit for a search warrant, which is really convincing. That's my cell phone going in the background. I'm clicking the ringer off. Sorry. So he puts together this affidavit for a search warrant, which lays out in really convincing detail that here's a kid with motive, means, and opportunity. He's not just thinking and talking about these things now. He's acting on it. He's actually building the bombs. And we've got a dangerous situation. We need to search his house. So when you read that search warrant, it's really chilling because this guy figured it out. But it was never taken to a judge. It was never executed. He got assigned to another case, a case of actual murder, a multiple murder that had happened there, never came back to it. It was never followed up on. It was filed and it was forgotten. And at that moment, something should have happened. And Eric's house should have been searched. The tricky question is, we don't really know what a search would have found in his house. Obviously, there's no way to have a record of what, you know, Eric's bedroom looked like at that point. This is before Eric had started his main production, bomb production. So he wouldn't have had a lot of explosives in the house, but Eric had already tested some. So there may have been one or two. So Columbine may or may not have been stopped at this point, but we should have at least made the attempt. That situation was bad enough that it was forgotten, but the day Columbine happened, the afternoon of the shooting, Jeffco immediately, of course, searched the police files when they realized who Eric and Dylan were and found they had files on them and found that this had all been, they had been warned about Eric. And they panicked and decided to cover it up. And they successfully covered up this evidence for about 5 years until there was a grand jury investigation, which finally uncovered the fact that these officials not only had decided to cover it up, they'd met to plan their cover up, and then kept that covered up for many years. But it all eventually came out. It's a very unfortunate part of the story, which I do cover in the book too. It's really sort of seedy end that they weren't just clean with the public, and that they may have had the opportunity to stop Columbine.
Well, has this now had an effect on law enforcement across the country to the extent that that they are going to try to be more tuned into any early signs of something like this, and with the hope that then you intervene at that point, you prevent something like this from happening?
Yes. Columbine really changed the country in several fundamental ways. It changed police forces in a couple ways. They also respond to these shootings differently. Instead of the defensive posture, where with Columbine, they surrounded the building and went into defensive mode. They set up a perimeter and waited for demands to be made. We don't do that anymore. Now we have what's called the active shooter protocol, which you saw at Virginia Tech and a lot of other shootings, where you charge the building. You assume if there is shooting going on, you go in aggressively and you try to neutralize the shooter. That has changed the way these things play out for the better. Saved a lot of lives, but also police departments and school officials, teachers, and also parents. Everyone views the world differently in a post-Columbine world, and when threats are made, we know to act on them. The Secret Service did a really exhaustive study of school shooters, of 20 years of school shooters, and found that in 81% of the cases that the killer told someone he was going to do it before doing it. In most cases, the killers told more than one person. So the answer in most cases really actually is pretty easy. It's just listen when the kids brag about it and spill the beans before they do it. The only trick there is that when I say it's easy, we have to listen. The we usually is kids. Would-be killers are usually bragging to their friends. Mm-hmm. So we have to convince teenage kids to take these threats seriously and to tell us. And most kids do. Since Columbine, most kids now, a little red flag goes off in their heads like, is he joking? Is this real? Should I tell someone? We've gotten ourselves into trouble after Columbine by trying to be a little too vigilant. And after Columbine, everybody who's probably a parent or teacher listening will know the phrase zero tolerance, which was implemented almost everywhere after Columbine, if a kid does anything, whether it's make a joke about killing someone or bring anything that can be construed as a weapon, there's zero tolerance. Depending upon the school, the kid is either expelled or suspended. The officials have no leeway. That has turned out to be a really dumb idea. And, one of the main outcomes of that is that kids
alert system. This system was developed to provide information to the public during emergencies. This was a test.
Need to learn from Columbine, and a lot of schools are figuring that out now and sort of backing off on the zero tolerance, but we have learned quite a bit.
We have a caller. We have about 10 minutes left. Let me again introduce our guest, Dave Cullen. He's a journalist and author. He's contributed to Slate, Salon, The New York Times, has a new book out that's based on his 10 years of work reporting on Columbine and the school shootings that there took place there in 1999. It's published by 12. It's out in the bookstores now if you want to look at it. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller here where we are, Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to ask about some broader, whether you have any thoughts about some broader ideas that were associated with people thinking about Columbine. And I don't want to make Michael Moore the spokesperson for it, because other people have thought of it as well, but I remember there was a lot of discussion about how, well, he made a specific reference to the fact that there's Columbine's economy, and that part of Colorado is based on the defense industry, as it's called euphemistically, and broader idea that U.S. as a society sort of from foreign policy to police force sort of endorses recourse to violence, that it's culturally very American. I think he uses the idea that there are lots of guns in Canada, but that they don't have the murder rate. It's not just accessibility to the guns. But so I don't know whether your analysis of the community or the details of these two guys' lives provides you any standing or insight on that, but I thought I should at least offer that, and I think I'm going to hang up and listen on.
Okay. Here. Well, let's see. What do you think?
Well, let's start with Michael Moore, who kind of irresponsibly introduced yet another series of myths into Columbine. The thing about the economy there being dominated by the defense industry is silly. There is a Martin Marietta does have some facilities out there. And back in the old days, 20, 30 years ago, when the area was just horse ranches, back in the 70s, before Columbine was built and before the area was awash with, it was basically fairly empty land. It was just horse ranches. And there was a big plant out there. There were quite a proportion of the people were working for Martin Marietta. However, in the 70s, when the suburban sprawl happened and that whole area was built up by developers and filled with 100,000 people, now the Martin Marietta plant is insignificant. It's a tiny fragment of the number of people working there. It's preposterous to even call them a significant employer for the area of anything of note. The people who are aware of the plant, who think about it, it's best known for working on space exploration. That's what they think of it as. So I think that is complete nonsense that the killers, even were aware or thought of that, or that it played any role in their lives or their thinking. Now, there's an interesting question about the wider question, though, of American culture versus other cultures. And there might be something there. I do get asked that when I talk to people from other countries when there have been school shootings there. I don't think that anybody has come up with a good analysis of that, because there's really no way to test that we have yet, with our social sciences. I mean, clearly we can see with Canada there's less violence in general. They seem to have a less aggressive culture than ours. They're different culturally. In Finland, they were really shocked by the two school shootings there, because they also have a very, very nonviolent culture. They don't have a lot of violent crime. So we're ahead of some of those countries in that, but you know, as to why our culture is more aggressive and more violent. No, I did not try to get into that in the book. I think it, you know, I think it goes deep into our cultural roots, but I didn't try to address that here.
All right. We are coming down to the point. We have maybe about 5 minutes or so. Back in the beginning, we talked about the fact that there are a lot of things that people think they know about this that were the result of the reporting right at within the first few hours after it happened, and the fact that the picture was confused. There was a lot of confusing, conflicting eyewitness testimony. You know, people who were there, the students who were there, said this happened, that happened, and you went back and saw that, in fact, maybe that wasn't really the way it was. If there's anything that people remember, one of the things I'm sure that people remember is the story of a girl who was one of the victims, a girl named Cassie Bernal.
Right.
And it was a very powerful, very dramatic story that moved a lot of people. This was the story, if people remember, is that she was there in the cafeteria one of the boys, Eric, came up to her, asked her if she believed in God. She said yes, and he shot her. And it actually, for a lot of people, was a very uplifting, kind of inspirational story. Knowing that helped her parents a lot.
Yep.
But one of the things that you found out was that it didn't happen.
Right, it didn't. And it's a really interesting story how this all unfolded and what happened with them. And Cassie Bernal and Misty, her mother, are two of the major characters in the book. That's one of the 10 storylines. And they're really interesting people. Cassie was fascinating before this happened because she got into all sorts of situations where she was threatening her own parents' life. And they had a horrible time with her. And they thought they had gotten through that. And then Cassie was killed. So they had already been through the ringer. And in that case, what happened was there were actually two girls involved in the library. So Cassie was sitting underneath a table, literally praying for her life, praying out loud, crying, seeing the killers going from table to table, killing people ruthlessly. She was praying. Eric walked up to her table, slapped his open palm on the table, said, "Peekaboo." He put the muzzle of his shotgun underneath the lip of the table and shot. Didn't even look, didn't even see who she was. Shot her in the head. She died instantly. She never had a chance to respond. She probably didn't even see him. She just saw the gun because the other girl under the table with her, Emily Wyant, saw the gun but not the face. So that was the end of Cassie's story. But what also happened in the library, and I may have said cafeteria.
Oh, no, I think I misspoke.
Yeah. Oh, okay. But in the library, elsewhere in the library, a girl named Val Schnurr was hit by one of Dylan's shotgun blasts. She was riddled with buckshot up and down her arms and legs. She was bleeding. She decided to make a go for it and didn't try running out of there. She couldn't run at the time. She tried to make a crawl for it and started furiously trying to crawl out of the library. Dylan saw her, accosted her, and started heckling her. Asked, "Do you believe in God? You know, because, you know, you're about to meet him." She said, "Yes." He said, "Oh, really? Why?" And he asked her, and they went back and forth in an exchange about it. In the middle of the exchange, he got distracted. Eric called over to him, and Dylan walked away. He didn't care who he killed, who lived or died, so he just walked away and let her live. So Val Schnurr lived to tell about it. She's doing fine, by the way. She's another wonderful character who went on. She's very happy right now. She's completely forgiven the killers, believe it or not. But she lived through it and lived to tell, was rushed into surgery, but she was okay. Now there was a boy listening to all this under one of the tables, Craig Scott, who didn't know either girl and had heard about Cassie, knew she was an evangelical Christian, and assumed, for some reason, that it was her, and started telling people that he'd heard this amazing story of a girl who'd stood up and said she believed in God, started telling people. The story went like wildfire. And her parents heard the story, and these are the parents who've lived through this situation with death threats from their daughter, who the daughter had turned around. They thought it was a beautiful story. Now, you know, Cassie had found God, and they thought it was an amazing story of redemption, and they told the story as well. Misty, the mom, wrote the book, got tremendous healing on her part of something good happening out of Columbine. It was a national bestseller. All turned out to be a mistake. I don't think Misty Bernal was trying to mislead anyone. She was personally misled and made a terrible mistake. And it really hurt her when the truth came out. But it was all a misunderstanding, and I try to go through in the book how these myths came about, but also how it affects the people involved. You know, what happened to the people who were at the center of these myths? What did it do to their lives? And I think that's also what Columbine is about. These myths that sprang up, they had repercussions. They affected real people. And sometimes in tragic ways, other people in uplifting ways. Yeah. Val Schnur just spoke at the 10th anniversary, and you know, she quoted Robert Frost on Life Goes On.
Yeah, there is so much more we could talk about. We're going to have to stop, but certainly if people would like to read more. And we've talked a lot about the two boys, and as you say, that there are many stories here that you're working to tell about all of the people that were involved, not just the two of them, but also the people who died, the people who survived, their families, what it all meant for the people as they tried to understand what it all meant. And if you'd like to read more, you look for the book. The title is Columbine by our guest Dave Cullen. It's published by 12 Books. And also you can find out more about him and read about the story on his website, Dave Cullen, C-U-L-L-E-N, DaveCullen.com. He's written for Slate, Salon, New York Times. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, David. The time goes really quickly, but it's been great being on.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. We first broadcast this show in May. You can hear many past shows from Focus 580 by going to the archives on our website. That's at our site. It's Will, W-I-L-L, will.illinois.edu. Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of foods from around the world, including cheeses, olives, spices, hot sauces, olive oils, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication thanks to the generosity of University of Illinois alumni Allison Robert Campbell. We'll break at this point for an update on the markets. We'll be back. Stay tuned.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
It's a minute before 11 o'clock. I'm Tom Rogers with this commodity market update. The concerns about a big crop in corn and soybeans, possibly even a record soybean crop, has pushed prices down across the boards on the grain. The September wheat right now in Minneapolis is trading down 10¾ cents at 494¼. December down 11, now down 10¾ as well at 510 a bushel. September wheat in Chicago is at 458¼, down 12¾ cents. The Dease contract down 13 at 485¾. September corn is down 7¾ cents right now at 318½ a bushel. December at 321, down 8¾. March 10 of 10 corn, 334¼, down 8¼. Crude oil right now is down 96 cents a barrel. It was up earlier, now trading around $69. RBOB gasoline at 180 2/10, down 7 tenths. September soybeans down 31 at 10.69 right now. November at 9.60½, down 19. January beans at 9.62¾, down 18½. March of next year, 9.62¼, down 17. September bean meal is currently trading down 6.